The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, three games in and the table is bookended by North London. The Red side are at the bottom and Arsenal by numbers, capitulation at the hands of Manchester City. Good for the first 5 minutes, non-existent defending and then Granit Xhaka. 2 5-0s in a row now for City. Title challengers Liverpool and Chelsea draw at Anfield with the spectacle ruined by a referee correctly applying the laws of the game. Manchester United get an undeserved win at Wolves while they sign Ronaldo. A good signing, a bad signing, and will this podcast be the only broadcasting outlet to mention the elephant in the room? There's Damari Gray being good again, Steve Bruce looking sad, some proper northern football at Burnley and Spurs topping the table. Elsewhere, there's Messi's debut for PSG, the European draws, Wilson's cricket and a tribute to Keith the Duck. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi Max.
Jonathan Wilson, hello.
All right, how you doing?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Thanks for asking. Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hello Max.
Should we start then at the Etihad? Manchester City 5, Arsenal 0. Smev85 says, what will this Arsenal team be called when they go the whole season without winning? Hashtag Vincibles. What did you make of this one, Barry?
I thought it was quite funny. I watched it in the company of several Arsenal fans, one of whom has a friend in prison who used his phone call to ring and mock him after goal number 4 went in. Now, I don't know how many phone calls you get, what kind of access you get to the phone in jail, but I'd imagine it's not great. I think that sort of speaks volumes about how far Arsenal have fallen. It was an embarrassing performance by them. I wasn't expecting much. I fully expected them to lose, but the manner of their capitulation was just pathetic.
I thought they started quite well, Wilson, for 5 minutes.
For 5 minutes, yeah. But I mean, it was just the inevitability of a collapse. And even then, you know, it's, you can talk about personnel, you can talk about tactics. I know there's clearly issues with both and recruitment, but there's just a mood about Arsenal that is counterproductive. And the Xhaka challenge is a classic example of that. And that's, I mean, it's obviously partly him losing his temper and flying in, but it's just the lack of responsibility. It's for saying, well, I'm not going to stay here and be part of this. I'm not going to try and fight to get something out of this. You know, maybe we can draw the second half and at least put together some kind of shape for the future. It was just, well, I don't fancy this. I'm going to fly in stupidly, get myself sent off, and you know, let's see. You know, the 10 of you can get on with it. And you know, Xhaka is one of those players who there's repeated attempts to rehabilitate him because he clearly is, in some regards, a good player. There are certain things he does on the pitch which are good. And you seem to see that far more for his country than you do for Arsenal. But then, just as you start thinking, maybe I have been too harsh on him, he goes and does something like that. And he's, you know, he is a liability. Arsenal have to get rid of him because he has become symptomatic of a wider problem.
Interesting thing, Ed, is as Wilson said, that, you know, the mood, there is a mood around the club. You sort of think at this elite level, a mood, and we've seen it with Mourinho sides in the last few years, you know, how important that is, that there's this kind of sort of inevitable momentum that seems so hard to shift.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the big shame about Arteta's reign at Arsenal, because he had that momentum at the start. They did pretty well and obviously won the FA Cup in his first, not even full season. And then since then, it's just, it's all unraveled. And you know, and we're in the situation that they find themselves in now. Bottom of the league, no points. And you know, just looking just bereft of any hope. A player that I've been talking about quite a lot recently to Arsenal fans and other reporters, that I think symbolises what's happened there and the problems there is Joe Willock. Surely a player like that deserves a chance after what he did on loan at Newcastle last year to show what he can do and maybe fight for a place in the team. But he was sold to Newcastle. Newcastle have got themselves a good deal there for an up-and-coming midfielder and somebody who actually cares about Arsenal, you know, once wanted to be in that team, wasn't given a chance. Whereas somebody like Xhaka, perhaps, all right, he does care about Arsenal a bit, but you saw his irresponsibility the other day that, you know, can't be relied on. And it's quite sad, really, to see the way that they're heading at the moment. You can't see any way it's going to be turned around under Arteta.
Well, I think that point about Willock, I think there's a serious possibility it turns into a Martinez situation where some decision seems to have been made. Like, this player's okay, but he's not necessarily going to be getting in the first team every week. So let's take the money for him. So Willock was, what, 22 million?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, just over 20 million anyway. Martinez was, I think, 15 or 17 maybe. So, yeah, to take a moderate sum of money because we just need a bit of cash coming in. And then a year later, they end up having to pay, half as much again to replace him. So Ramsdale coming in for 30 million to replace a player you had for 17 million, who's probably better. And I suspect a similar thing might happen with Willock, that next summer they decide, actually, we could do with a box-to-box, a player who gets in the opposition's area, will get you goals from midfield, and they end up spending 35, 40 million when actually they could have just extended Willock's contract and they'd have had him anyway and had somebody who'd been brought up at the club who had some emotional attachment there.
I really enjoyed Cedric's stats for the game. Cedric Suarez, tackles 0, successful dribbles 0, ground duels 1-0, aerial duels 1-0, key passes 0, crosses 0, accurate long balls 0, errors leading to a goal 1. The sort of thing Barry could have played right back. You could have done all of that. I mean, perhaps more errors leading to a goal, possibly, but otherwise, you might have won a header by mistake.
Well, I'd like to think I'd have won a header. There's a couple of headers were missed by various Arsenal players that I think I could have made a better fist to get in the ball. I mean, even if you look past the basic errors, and Cedric clearly isn't good enough, Arteta was so... Like, he did nothing when Xhaka got sent off. He gave him a little pat on the bum as he made his way up the tunnel, when he should have been furious at the stupidity of his red card. And then didn't bring anyone on until half time and allowed City to score another goal because there was this yawning gap in midfield. So I was talking to Perry Groves yesterday and he's furious over this, a big gooner obviously, and he said he doesn't mind them getting beaten so much and he wasn't expecting them to do anything against City, but he just wants to see players who care about the shirt and who are trying, and there's no sign of that.
We should mention, look, City, Rodri's finish was absolutely beautiful. And there's lots of chat about Man City needing a centre-forward. Alan Shearer sort of took apart Ferran Torres' performance on Match of the Day, and it looked very much like that's what a centre-forward does, like his movement, his sort of ducking one way and going the other and all those things that a centre-forward does, Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, they won the league last season. I mean, they had Aguero, but they didn't really use him. So I think it's a slightly oversimplistic argument to say they need a centre forward. Having said that, what a Kane would give you, or a Haaland would give you, is if you're not playing particularly well, they can burgle a goal from somewhere. That, if City's passing does get gummed up, which very, very occasionally it does, it might be quite useful to have somebody you can whack the ball along to, or somebody who might be able to nick something from a set play. But it's almost as to give him a straightforward plan B. But that centre forward is useless unless he can also integrate into the plan A. Now, I think Kane will be able to. Haaland, I think, also will be able to. But it's not just get a centre forward and that'll do. It's got to be the right type of centre forward. And I think I guess we'll come on to Ronaldo later, but City being linked with Ronaldo made absolutely zero sense to me. If Aguero wasn't doing enough of the movement and the defensive work and the wasn't fulfilling his positional responsibilities in the way that Guardiola wanted, there's no way Ronaldo would have been able to. So that mooted signing made zero sense to me. And I think they're better off without a centre forward than with Ronaldo.
Let's go to Anfield. Liverpool 1, Chelsea 1. The penalty, Ed. Lars Lars pointing out on Twitter, it was a penalty. There are two separate discussions getting mixed up here. Do we think it should be a red card? Does it feel right and fair? And is it a penalty and a red card under the current laws of the game? And I think, from my point of view, it is a red card. It is a penalty. I'd rather it wasn't a red card, but it should be a penalty.
Yeah, this is a bit of a grey area, I think, that's been highlighted by this incident, in that, you know, the law's been tweaked, isn't it, for if it was a, say it was a foul in the area, denying a goal-scoring opportunity, then now it's not, you don't always get punished twice, it's the double jeopardy idea. But in this case, you do, so perhaps it's something that they could look at in the future, because it did really completely change the game. I was at Anfield, and Liverpool had a very good start, you know, all up and at them, but then Chelsea really took control of the game, went ahead, could have scored more, and then Liverpool looked like they were hanging on a little bit until that incident, and James was sent off. And Thomas Tuchel was really angry about the fact that the referee, Anthony Taylor, didn't seem to look at the video of the incident, right? He just looked at a still image, which, when it was clearly, you know, striking his hand, I think it was, you know, going to be a penalty anyway, to be honest. But it was a good talking point afterwards. But yeah, generally, I think that FIFA should probably look at this, because, it's not great when you get a red card that early in the game, because it really just changes the whole balance of it. And although Liverpool really struggled to break Chelsea down after that.
You're not getting punished twice. You're getting punished once. That the red card is the punishment, because he stopped a goal being scored. So you've gone from a guaranteed goal to a chance of a goal from a penalty spot. So that's an advantage to the opposition team, not to you. So the red card is the punishment. And if you don't punish that with a red card, then every player is going to be blocking shots on the line, because they know they...
Yeah, but there's a massive difference between doing what Suarez did against Ghana, for instance, where he's deliberately saved the ball, and a ball flicking off, you know, you moving your thigh to the ball flicking off your thigh or hip up onto your arm. There's no way Rhys James did that deliberately. And that's why I'm slightly puzzled, and this is my ignorance rather than anything else, and I've Googled and tried to find an explanation, I haven't been able to find one. Is that actually deliberate? Is that actually an offence? My understanding was, if a ball flicks off your body onto your arm, it's not a foul. Is that different if you're on the line? I just don't know the answer to that. Maybe it is different.
But he did deliberately sort of bat the ball away with his hand.
Nah, the ball flicks off his thigh. There's no, it's not, he hasn't sort of gone to save it.
As Tuchel said, his arm wasn't really in an unnatural position. It just went up and struck him without him, you know, knowing anything about it, I think.
What about a penalty goal in that situation? Where let's say the Suarez situation, where you go, that's a goal. Goal for you, Ghana.
Yeah, I think so. Having been in that there for that match, it was the biggest travesty I've ever seen in my life. And, you know,
or to be really, really cruel, what about a penalty with no keeper, just for that tiny fraction of people who would manage to miss the target?
Just don't let Christian Benteke take it.
Do you have to, or Diana Ross? Do you have to blast it?
Yeah, you'd have to hit the net. If it just trickled over the line, it wouldn't count.
Wow, that's quite hard to. I'd say it's harder to put the pace on the ball where it stops before it hits the net but crosses the line. So I have to be a snooker player to do that. Was this a defensive masterclass, though, from Tuchel, Wilson, after...
Yeah, second half, I thought... I mean, look, Chelsea obviously would have rather had the win, but in terms of long-term prognosis, to play like that in the second half against a team as good going forward as Liverpool... And, okay, Liverpool had a couple of chances, but there was never sustained pressure. There was never sort of the barrage of chances. To hold a team that good at arm's length for 45 minutes with 10 men, I think that suggests the... I mean, we saw it with Chelsea in the Champions League last stages last year, how good they are defensively. And then, yeah, they're still that good. I think that is something that a lot of the super clubs don't have, that defensive nous, the organisation, the discipline. And if Chelsea have it, that gives them a massive advantage over the other big teams. So whether that's enough to overhaul City, I don't know, but certainly it puts them very, very close, and it should put them very close to retaining the Champions League.
Wolves, Manchester United. Wolves deserved to win this game, Barry, didn't they? They had so many chances. And I mean, this is a story of their season so far, isn't it?
Yeah, they seem to be morphing into this season's Brighton, because they've played three, lost three, they haven't scored. And I've seen all three of their games, and I think they were the better team in all three games. So hopefully their fans won't get on the manager's back. They'll have seen these performances too. They must be frustrated. I am absolutely baffled that they didn't get something out of this game, because they clearly deserve to win. Their finishing, obviously, is abysmal. I believe they've had over 50 shots on goal in their three games and haven't scored yet. So that sort of tells you all you need to know. I haven't looked up their XG, but I'd imagine it's quite large. But it's a worry for them. And then I would say I wouldn't be particularly concerned, but I sort of said the same thing about Fulham last season, that they were playing well enough to stay up comfortably, and they just sank like a stone in the end. So, worrying for Wolves, but I wouldn't be hitting the panic button anytime soon.
Ed, that is a foul by Paul Pogba, isn't it? I mean, I think it's a pretty dangerous challenge, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the intent was the main thing, wasn't it? Even though he only sort of just clipped him. But, you know, the still of that, talking about still images earlier, the still of that, which my friend sent to me yesterday and is in quite a lot of newspapers on the back pages, is you know, pretty damning, isn't it? And I think a lot of people are criticising Neves for having a late reaction to that, but it wasn't like a play-acting thing. He was, you know, concentrating on trying to play the ball and then realised, I think, that he had been caught. And that's why he went down in sort of, you know, sometimes when you stub your toe and there's a bit of a delayed reaction, that kind of thing. But yeah, and it was an absolutely pivotal moment, obviously, in the game and leading directly to the goal. So yeah, I'm not surprised that Wolves were really angry.
Yeah, on Traore, who did have he had that one run where he basically made all the Man United players disappear but you know, he can't finish. And we were discussing Ronaldo being a kind of siege engine or a catapult, like brilliant, but you have to wheel him into position. Jamie saying if Ronaldo is a siege engine, what is the complete opposite of that? And is it Adama Traore? He seems to power into the box time after time and do nothing with it. Maybe some sort of attack dog, but with wine gum teeth. I thought that's quite a nice description.
Or maybe like a horse that you would use to pull the siege weapon. But then your horse just running into a wall. That's kind of pointless, right? So yes. You need the two together.
Absolutely right. Away from the match, Cristiano Ronaldo signed for Manchester United. Paul says, what is the most extravagant thing you ever bought to get one over your neighbour? And was it a 36-year-old Portuguese man? lots of questions for Wilson about this. Is Wilson okay? The Ronaldo transfer, this is N, says this seems to have wound him up. He was laughing when he was going to City. Now he's gone to United, he's all over the place. Tim, are Manchester United to Jonathan Wilson what Meghan Markle is to Piers Morgan? Before you answer those questions, Wilson, Jay Humper said, I'm excited to hear from Ed how the Ronaldo transfer came about.
To sum it up briefly, it's probably a bit of a masterclass from George Mendes. Ronaldo was looking to leave Juventus pretty much the whole summer. Time was running out. There weren't really any firm suitors until City came along when the Kane move was obviously not going to happen. And then within sort of 24 hours of City thinking that they had some sort of agreement with the Ronaldo, things all changed. Thanks to the intervention of quite a few Manchester United legends, including Sir Alex Ferguson, who apparently was up till the early hours speaking to Ronaldo and sort of getting Ed Woodward to speak to Agnelli at Juventus. And then, yeah, within a few hours, we all saw what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said at his press conference on Friday lunchtime. At the same time, Pep was speaking quite downbeat about the whole thing, and I think we all knew what was going to happen after that, because you know, the pull of coming back to Manchester United was obviously very strong for Ronaldo, given everything that had happened. And it's very interesting to see what's going to happen with him. You know, they've got so many attacking players now. Where do they all fit in, and what does it mean for younger players like Jadon Sancho and Mason Greenwood?
Wilson, what do you think? I mean, have they just got him so City couldn't have him, or
yeah,
you know, is this good for their football team?
No, it's a stupid move. I don't. You know, this idea that I'm anti-United is just bizarre. You know, it's all I've done is pointed out that I don't think Solskjaer is the manager to win them the league or the Champions League, and I think Ronaldo is a waste of money who will be actively detrimental to the team. You know, his move to Juventus is one of the worst transfers in the history of football. And, okay, he's got 81 goals in three seasons in the league. Great. Did they win the league in each of those three seasons? No. Had they won the league in each of the seven seasons before he got there? Yes. Is he the sole reason why they didn't win the league last year? No. Is he indicative of a policy based on celebrity that led him to appoint Andrea Pirlo? Yes. He was brought in to help them win the Champions League. Did they win the Champions League? No. Are they further away now from winning the Champions League than they were when he signed? Yes. They got to two finals in the 4 years before he got there. When he was there, they lost in the quarterfinal, last 16. The teams they lost in the last 16 were Porto and Lyon. He has made them into a team not good enough to beat teams who aren't even winning the league in Portugal and France. But he's going to affect the development of Mason Greenwood. I think we've seen from the Portugal national team that Ronaldo and Bruno Fernandes don't necessarily work well together. I think to get in all these attacking players you're talking about, Pogba's probably going to have to play as the second deep-lying midfielder. Well, you saw on Sunday, he can't do that. He and Fred got overrun by Wolves. Wolves who haven't won a game yet. So this is, you know, he'll probably score 20 goals because he scores goals. And he will score goals against Burnley and Norwich and Brighton and whoever. Will he help them win the league? No. They're further away now than they were on Friday morning. Will they win the Champions League with him? No, they're further away now than they were on Friday morning. Old Trafford's being turned to this Manchester United theme park with people who scored winning goals or important goals in Champions League finals being given key positions. That is not the way to run a football club. There's a mountain of sugar being forced onto the spoon to that metaphor doesn't work. but these are sops being offered to placate the fan base, so they don't notice that they're nowhere near winning the league, despite spending £500 million in the last 5 years. They're miles off Chelsea. They're miles off City.
I mean, if this was Question Time, I think there'd certainly be half the audience would be on their feet and half would be sort of tutting and booing and waiting for Dominic Raab to say something. Andy writes, how are morally conscious Manchester United fans supposed to feel on the Ronaldo transfer based on the allegations against him? When we talk about this signing, I think it is important to cover the rape allegations against Ronaldo, which were published in Der Spiegel in 2018, and something that has been conspicuously absent from pretty much all the coverage of the transfer. From Der Spiegel, the American Catherine Mayorga alleges that Ronaldo raped her in a Las Vegas hotel in 2009, allegations which he denies. After negotiations, Ronaldo's legal representatives reached an agreement with Mayorga for an out-of-court settlement in January 2010, and she received $375,000 for keeping quiet. In late September 2018, she went public with her accusations following further legal advice. In conversations with Der Spiegel, she related her version of what happened in 2009, how severely the incident traumatised her. She said she's never been able to get beyond the event and find peace. Ronaldo responded at the time, saying, keen as I may be to clear my name, I refuse to feed the media spectacle created by people seeking to promote themselves at my expense. My clear conscience will thereby allow me to await with tranquility the results of any and all investigations. I mean, I would urge anyone to read that piece in Der Spiegel, the whole thing. Is it something we have a duty to report when mentioning Ronaldo, Barry? And if so, how often do we need to say it? Because we have covered it before, and then we just spoke about him as a Juventus player. Like, do we talk about it now and we then never refer to it again?
God, ask me a hard one, why don't you? I think we do have a duty to mention it. I don't really see the point in mentioning it every single time we talk about Ronaldo, but the fact of the matter is that while police have decided there isn't enough evidence for him to have to answer a case, this woman, Catherine Mayorga, has launched a civil case. There will be Manchester United fans who literally don't care whether he's guilty or not. And I presume there will be others who are slightly uncomfortable with it. I'd certainly be uncomfortable with it.
Ed, you probably know more about this than me, but there is actually a legal issue that you cannot repeat an allegation repeatedly about somebody, even if you keep saying it's an allegation, that the repetitive nature of that I think can lead you to leave you open to charges of defamation. So I think there's a very simple legal reason why you don't mention it all the time. It's obviously legitimate to mention it at certain key junctures. But I mean that's why you won't see in a match report, you know, Ronaldo, who has been accused of rape, scored a hat-trick.
All the evidence came from, you know, the Football League's cash, Rui Pinto, who's still on trial in Lisbon at the moment, but helping authorities, not just in Portugal, but in other countries as well, in some very high-profile tax investigations. So this is quite an interesting question about whether, you know, a whistleblower is acting properly or not, or if actually the stuff that he's passing on is stolen information or not. And that's really what this case is all based upon, isn't it? The Spiegel original article back in 2018.
I think that's an interesting... I sort of feel domestic violence and sexual abuse is sort of something that is very rarely spoken about because it's very difficult to talk about. It's legally difficult to talk about. If you're doing a football show, it's quite hard to get the tone right and then go into something that is clearly far less important. So I sense that when I hear people talking about, you know, footballers who have been accused of domestic violence or sexual violence, that it's just never ever mentioned, you know, it's just never ever brought up, and you sort of think it's quite a big, you know, it's a big part of that human's history. And
well, it is, but it's very difficult when, you know, if police say there's not enough evidence to press
charges. That's true. No, of course,
it's absolutely not for us to pass judgment
either. No, that's true, but I'm thinking about, say, Kingsley Coman, who was found guilty,
right,
for example,
sure, yeah, yeah,
you know, in a story like that, and it's sort of, it's, and that's, and you know, there is a real link. If you think about domestic violence, there was a study done by LSE really recently about the amount that domestic violence increases when a team's a fans' football team loses, and you know, sort of saying early kickoffs are really bad for domestic violence because it means more time for people to drink and then go home and, you know, beat up their girlfriend or their wife.
In America, there's been quite a lot of studies into this, and the NFL have introduced very harsh penalties for players that get even just accused of sexual violence or domestic violence. You get an automatic ban, even if you're just accused of it. So they've taken a very strong stand on this, and it's something that perhaps Premier League should be considering.
The Manchester City footballer Benjamin Mendy has been remanded in custody after appearing in court charged with 4 counts of rape and a sexual assault. He's accused of offences against 3 women, including one aged under 18, a court heard on Friday. One of the alleged rapes is said to have taken place at his home in Cheshire this week when he was on police bail for other sexual offences, Chester Magistrates Court were told. The 3 other counts of rape date to October 2020. The sexual assault is alleged to have taken place in January this year. We can't talk in detail about this case. There is an interesting piece in The Athletic asking whether it was right for Mendy to continue playing. Mendy been facing allegations from the previous October. People in charge at City knew, as we now know, decided against suspending their player. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll get back to the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go to the London Stadium. West Ham 2, Crystal Palace 2. WGK says, West Ham are the best team in the world. Discuss. I mean, difficult after a draw at home to Palace. Ed, you are Palace, and we don't devote a huge amount of time to Palace, so let's devote some time to Palace.
It's quite funny, actually, that Palace, they're a bit of a bogey team for West Ham. I think Jacob Steinberg would acknowledge this as well. That every time West Ham looked like it's going really well for them, Palace somehow managed to get, I know it's not a win, but it felt a bit like a win, actually, as a Palace fan, because they hadn't even scored a goal until Conor Gallagher's equaliser, and then an even better second goal from the Chelsea loanee to get an equaliser against the top of the table, West Ham, until Tottenham's win on Sunday, of course. But yeah, it was really, really heartening, because I think if Palace had lost that game, gone into the international break with just 1 point and no goals, and the pressure would have been mounting on Vieira. But there were signs definitely in the second half that something is beginning to stir there, and I think Gallagher is going to be really important in that. When Eze comes back, it'll be really important, and I think actually the next couple of days pretty important as well. They're trying to get another striker in, Odson Edouard or perhaps Eddie Nketiah from Arsenal.
And Antonio had another brilliant performance. We have spoken at length already this season about how good he is. I thought the composure with Fornals' goal was brilliant. Let's go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs 1, Watford 0. Played 3, won 3, scored 3, conceded 0. The only side with a 100% record. How well are Tottenham playing, Wilson?
Oh, I mean, look very, very solid. You imagine they'll become more fluid as Kane sort of reintegrates. And Watford are... the criticism of Watford last season, where they were actually very good, I think they probably weren't quite praised enough last season, Watford, is that they didn't score goals away from home. I think they only got 19 away from home last season, which wasn't even in the top half of teams in the Championship for away goals. But they are solid away from home. And so it wasn't a huge surprise that Tottenham would win that game narrowly without conceding. I guess the fixtures has been generous to Tottenham, which sounds slightly odd given they played City first up. But I don't think City will be as bad as that in any of the other 37 games this season. They got them when they were cold. And then, Wolves are still in some kind of process of settling. You know, Watford, I think, will be bottom five. Might not go down, but they're certainly going to be lower mid-table at best. So, yeah, they're doing well. They're solid, but there'll be much bigger tests ahead.
I thought Moussa Sissoko to Watford is a transfer that could have happened at any time in the last 5 years. And he had one run, didn't he? When I thought, oh no, you're not going to... Every Spurs fan must be thinking, he can't, can he? He can't, after so many years, just sort of burst past the left back and just put it in the top corner. Anyway, well done, Tottenham, top of the league. Newcastle 2, Southampton 2. Oh, Barry, Steve Bruce looked so sad, didn't he? I mean, whatever happened, he said these decisions have gone against us, i.e. the penalty that was a penalty, but still, that is brutal, isn't it?
Not necessarily, because Newcastle bring a lot of this on themselves through their habit of sitting back, inviting the opposition onto them as they try to protect a lead, and that leads to late goals from deflections or penalties. And their first half performance in this game was absolutely abysmal. They somehow got away with it, almost got the win, and then shot themselves in the foot again. I thought it was slightly harsh because Lascelles did make a heroic attempt to get the ball off Adam Armstrong before, as he shaped a shoot, and just didn't quite get there in time. So that in that regard, it was unfortunate, but they shouldn't have been in that position. Like, they gave the ball away, I think someone, Alan Shearer pointed out in Match of the Day, four times in the build-up to that attack, and they just shouldn't have done that. The fans turned vocally, audibly turned on Bruce in this game, and I can't see any way back for him. To weasel his way back into, well, he was never in their affections, but to change their mind. They don't want him there, but whether or not he will be sacked, I don't know.
Brighton 0, Everton 2. Has Rafa made this side too good to lift the Everton Cup? I think, Wilson, they look quite balanced, don't they? I think Damari Gray, as we mentioned in the last pod, he scored another one, seems to be an absolute bargain. And Andros Townsend, you know, who was not a signing that would sort of get Everton fans blissfully excited, actually gives them quite a lot of balance.
Yeah, I mean, they look sort of two mid-table signings, but actually, Demarai Gray particularly has started the season brilliantly. I mean, he was, what, 1.5 million? Mm-hmm. So it's two goals already. That's, I know he's getting wages as well, but he's pretty much paid off his transfer fee. You know, isn't there some study that says every Premier League goal's worth 800 grand?
Is that right?
I think I remember that, yeah. So, yeah, you know, he's already paid off his fee. Now he's got to pay off his wages.
Richarlison really wanted to take the penalty, didn't he?
Oh, it's pathetic, that, isn't it?
Tuchel says, would the panel want to see Richarlison sign for PSG and fight Neymar and Messi for taking the penalty? I don't know. I it's one of those things where everyone goes on about massive disrespect, and clearly it's ridiculous. But I'm the more games where people are fighting over taking a penalty, the happier I generally am, Ed. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I like to see a bit of a scrap over the spot. But actually, talking of a penalty spot scraps, what about Rudiger's scuffling up of the spot?
Oh, yes.
He's a terror, isn't he, old Rudiger? He's just always involved somewhere in the background. Just...
No one did it more than... Was it Yerry Mina? Who did it for Colombia when England got that penalty? I mean, he didn't... He almost, like, he basically got a shovel out and just started digging the penalty spot. Matthew says, I'm an Everton fan who's pretty underwhelmed by the signing of Solomon Rondon. 2 or 3 years ago, maybe, but now at 32 and after a few years in China, I'm not sure. Can you just let Wilson spend the whole pod telling me why I'm wrong? I can't remember the context, but at some point you did...
He's the best player in the world.
You did announce that Solomon Rondon was the best player in the world.
No, because you clipped the second half of the sentence. What I said was, playing as a very isolated centre-forward where the midfield's sitting 30 or 40 yards deep of him, where his job is to hold the ball up, get a free kick, get a throw in, he's the best player in the world. In other aspects, he's not. But
still, in his peak, I'm not sure he's... You're saying he's the best ever centre... Is he the best ever at running the channels? Is that what you're saying?
Not best ever. Okay. I'd say, yeah, because the way he played for Venezuela and often for Newcastle was to be the only player in the opposition half, and the rest of the team would be sort of stuck on the edge of your own box. If you're whacking the ball long to him and he's got sort of four or five defenders around him, he's exceptionally good at just, you know, getting something, you know, a throw-in, holding it up for 20 seconds for people to join him, getting a free kick. I love watching him. I think he's a master of that. And he shares his birthday with Karl-Heinz Riedler, Neville Southall, and Lauren Bacall.
Norwich 1, Leicester 2. Brendan Rodgers, Barry, said, a 3 o'clock kickoff at Carrow Road in the sunshine is never going to be easy. I'd suggest it... I'd suggest it doesn't get easier in the Premier League, does it?
Because the position of the sun in relation to the ground, or...
I don't know. It was just, you know, it was just sort of... He trotted out this line that I presume he thought no one would listen to.
No, but he had a smirk on his face. I think he knew what he was
doing.
Do
you think so?
There's a little tweak of the lips as he said it. I think he was taking the piss.
Perhaps it's because the sun reflects off his new teeth. That's maybe why it's such
into Jamie Vardy's eyes, and then Jamie Vardy can't do anything. The one moment, I mean, it was quite a fun game, but Kenny McLean's equaliser is ruled out, Baz, because someone, I forget who, is standing on the keeper.
Todd Cantwell
standing on the keeper, and it is offside. But I wonder if, when we go to IFAB with all our tweaks, you say, look, Schmeichel's not getting that ball anyway, so just let him have the goal.
I definitely see your point, and
I don't.
Daniel Farke, after the game, embarked on a lengthy whine about how, because Kasper Schmeichel is taller than Todd Cantwell, the fact that Todd Cantwell is basically standing on his toes shouldn't make any difference. He can't be interfering with play because he's not blocking Schmeichel's view. That was gibberish of the highest order.
You're saying that short players can't be offside, is what we're saying.
Yeah, short players can't interfere with play unless they're holding their hands up in front of an opposition player's eyes, blocking their view. So yeah,
but Todd Cantwell has quite long hair, so like his hair could be drifting up into Schmeichel's face. So you have to take that into account as well.
Short people with short hair.
He may have used some sort of pungent shampoo and conditioner, which was, getting in Schmeichel's nostrils and putting him off, or making his eyes water and therefore blurring his vision. I don't know, but. It wouldn't be top of my list of tweaks to being to IFAB, that's for sure.
Are you saying short skinheads can't be offside because they couldn't? Who's that?
Great news for Kevin Phillips.
Phil Stamp and Kevin Phillips can never be offside.
Well, I actually saw Kevin Phillips doing punditry somewhere over the weekend, and he is quite a quiff, which I would suggest is unbecoming of a man of his age. He's too old to be rocking a haircut like that.
Okay,
not a skinhead.
What's the cutoff for a quiff, Baz?
Well, there isn't necessarily a cutoff for a quiff. It's the one he has. Mark Kermode's quiff is his trademark, and he's considerably older than Kevin Phillips. But maybe it's not even. But just the hairstyle he has doesn't suit. It's more suited to someone on Love Island than someone trying to be taken seriously as a football pundit, I would argue.
Would Kevin Phillips have scored even more goals in that season had he had Mark Kermode's quiff while doing it? Villa 1, Brentford 1. Ivan Toney got his first Premier League goal. Something good about a commentator just yelling, Tony. It's almost like, I think it was Robin Cowan. It's almost just like an EastEnders, Tony, get in here. That goal where a Brentford player nicked the ball out of Emi Martinez's hands. Can we give that, can we send our tweaks to Ivan Wilson? Can we have that one?
No.
Okay, fine. Burnley 1, Leeds 1. Burnley made Leeds fun in quite a dirty way. This felt very 1970s, Ed. It was just sort of, it was some violence with a bit of football.
Yeah, Ashley Barnes was right in the middle of it, wasn't he? And there was that incident when the referee allowed play to continue despite a clear offside, really. And he smashed into the Leeds player and it you know, for a couple of minutes, it looked like they could be both actually be injured. So, and you know, and a serious point, this new rule of them continuing when there's clearly an offside and the linesman not putting a flag up until way after is obviously going to end with somebody getting injured at some point. And I think they need to come up with another idea, really.
Up to Joe, Chris Wood's strike was the 30,000th goal ever scored in the Premier League. Milestone. I have pitched for a pod for Barry to do a countdown, 30,000 to one, sort of top of the pop style charts of every goal ever in the Premier League. Wiley K.
What's at one? Yeboah?
Oh, Yeboah is, I think Yeboah is, I'm more interested in what's at 26,000. Are they all penalties? Like, are they just penalties from 30,000 to like 22,000?
Well, own goals as
own
well.
Own goals, of course. But I think own goals could be higher than penalties. You know, one is, I mean, that's in the top 25 for me.
Well, wouldn't this countdown be in chronological order?
Oh, no, I want it in quality order. Wiley K, 81, says, there is something about big guys getting the landmark goals, isn't there? Brian Dean with the first, Mike Newell the 1,000th, Celez the 10,000th. Have to skip 20,000th because it's probably a small skinhead who wasn't offside. 25,000th, Zlatan, and the 30,000th goal to Chris Wood. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, Fitbar Corner, bit of Europe, any other business? Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Can we have all your money, please? Barry, we got sent an email. We did a very successful tout for business from listeners who don't contribute to how important the Guardian is. I wouldn't say we're the important bit, but when we did tout for business, we got loads of money and people were impressed with us. So can you tout for some business?
Yeah, well, we've been producing this podcast for years and years and years now.
Three years.
And it's available free of charge, but you know, it costs money to make. I think we provide quite a decent service, so you know, if you're a freeloading round dodger, maybe it's time to pony up a few quid, if you can afford it. If you can't afford it, no problem. Just, you know, wait for some time until such time as you can. But if you can afford to bung some money our way in return for this wonderful service you're getting, Max will furnish you with the details of how you can do that. And if you do that, it will help make us look good.
It's important to emphasise all Guardian content is listener and reader funded. We operate independently of a big billionaire owner. Although I'd love it if we had one and we could go and ask for loads of money for us, who can censor what we say and write. The pod has millions of regular and ad hoc listeners around the world. We couldn't do what we do without your support. You can give as little as a pound and it only takes a minute. support.theguardian.com/contribute. support.theguardian.com/contribute. Thank you for all your money. Fitbar Corner. Oh, don't, let's not go into Fitbar Corner off the back of asking for some money. We're meant to say the quality that we deliver and how this shite. Oh, dear. Barry, the pressure's on.
Oh, crikey. Yeah, and if you are handing over money, make sure you make, if there's a facility to let them know why you're giving the money, make sure to let them know it's because of us, specifically Football Weekly. Anyway, Football Corner, there was an Old Firm derby. It wasn't very good. Rangers won 1-0 through a Philip Hlander goal scored from a header from a corner. Joe Hart had an interesting afternoon. It was at Ibrox, his first Old Firm derby. He had cardboard missiles of some description were raining down on his goal all throughout the first half, which can't have made life easy for him. It was interesting because in the build-up, Rangers had a COVID outbreak, so Steven Gerrard wasn't there. Gary McAllister deputised for him in the touchline, and they were missing James Tavernier and their two first-choice goalkeepers, but Robbie McCrory was in goal for them, his third choice, and he had a very, very good game. There were high hopes for Celtic's new striker, Kyogo Furuhashi. He was played out wide instead of through the centre where Ange Postecoglou has been playing him. And he didn't have a brilliant game. I mean, there was one stage near the end. He had a shot when he should have squared the ball for Ryan Christie. And then moments later, he squared the ball to nobody when he should have had a shot. So it's a game that probably could have gone either way. It's a brilliant win for Rangers under the circumstances. And Odson Edouard missed a sitter at 0-0, which was just a criminal miss. And I'd say he's taken, knocked a couple of million off his value with that one. It was just awful.
The Champions League draw was done on Friday.
Thursday,
pretty fun
it?
Groups
Thursday.
In here. Was it Thursday? Yeah. I thought it was Friday. Oh, it was Friday in Australia. I have to get that right, won't I? Group A, Man City, PSG together, along with RB Leipzig and Club Brugge. Liverpool are in with Milan, Atleti and Porto. It's quite a nice mini break. That's a mini break group, isn't it, for the travelling Liverpool fans. Manchester United with Atalanta, Villarreal and Young Boys. Chelsea, we've got Juve, Malmo and Zenit. So there's some interesting games to look forward to in the Champions League, I would suggest, Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, I think that United group is interesting, with given that Villarreal sort of restricted them so comfortably in the Europa League final. I think that's a test of whether United really have improved with the new signings this season. I'm pretty sure City and PSG will go through, but Leipzig, who were probably not as strong as they were last season because they've lost their two centre-backs and their manager, but they mean that they can't afford to sort of take things easy at the start. And that Liverpool group's testing as well. So, I mean, the thing with Champions League tours, it's never the second team in the group, it's always the third team that makes it interesting. And those three groups all have three decent teams. So there's been many, many worse draws.
FC Sheriff, the first side from Moldova, are in Group D with Inter, Real Madrid and Shakhtar. There was quite an astonishing thread sent about the history of FC Sheriff. We don't have time to do it today, but we'll when the Champions League comes around, we'll read it out, because it's a wild story about a team that I knew very little about. Sorry to tease you and then not furnish you with the information. That's quite rude, but, you know, look forward to it in a pod in a couple of weeks. James says, in the Europa League draw, has any group in a tournament deserved the title Group of Death more than Lazio, Lokomotiv Moscow, Marseille and Galatasaray? That's one for the if you're a touring steward, that would be a disappointing group to get, wouldn't it? Ben says, can we get a reaction from Wilson to the new series of Vera? No spoilers, please. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet because I was playing cricket yesterday and I'm currently staying in a hotel, going to play cricket again today.
Oh, there we are. Well, Max says, can you ask Wilson to talk us through his 60 off 56 balls at the weekend? It looks like you wore... Like when you come off a cricket pitch, I mean, you look like sort of a mix between Brian Robson after that Morocco game in Mexico 86 and Terry Butcher. Like there's so much sweat. I was going to say blood, sweat and tears, but obviously we know, you know, crying, you know... Although, you know, actually, you burst into tears on the pod quite regularly. I take that back.
twice.
Talk us through your... I think I've burst into tears three times. I can't remember. Anyway, there'll be more, I'm sure. But carry on.
I was covered in blood, and I had no idea where it had come from. I was at the non-strike zone. The umpire went, "What's happened? And what do you mean?" And it was like blood just dripping, and I had a cut on the top of my nose. I don't know how it had come there. And you know how your face just bleeds. So yeah, I was dripping with blood, and it was a slightly damp day, and I'm a sweaty man, and under a helmet. But yeah, we won the game by, I think, 98 runs. Took 3 for 23 as well, bowling absolute filth. But I felt very bad. We got a very good young off spinner who bowled beautifully with very little reward. Okay. And then I came on for him and mopped up all the wickets.
Yeah, with the pies.
But that's experience for you.
Absolutely. William says, 15-minute tribute to Keith. Stuart says, any thoughts on Wigan Athletic holding a minute's applause for a pet duck called Keith? Can we have a moment of reflection for Keith the duck, says Jake. Can we have a moment of reflection for Keith the Duck, Barry?
Keith, that was an interesting story at Wigan last week. I think on one of their fan forums, the death of someone called Keith was announced, and somebody else misinterpreted, thought it was a member of their group called Keith. But it wasn't. It was someone's pet duck called Keith. So I think they'd got on to the club to see about organising a pre-match tribute for the fan Keith, who wasn't dead. And instead, Wigan put on a tribute, having learned that this was a mistake and that they hadn't lost one of their fans. Wigan put on a scoreboard tribute for Keith the Duck, and there was minutes applause for him, and may he rest in peace.
Perfectly said, Barry. And what a wonderful place to end the podcast. Unless, Barry, Zvonimir says, can Barry cover Men at Work's Down Under to welcome Max to his new Australian home? Would you like to end the pod with your tribute to Keith, or would you like to read the lyrics to Men at Work's Down Under?
I would be reluctant to cover Men at Work's Down Under because I believe they got sued for stealing a bit of the music from, can't remember who, but there was a very costly lawsuit and Men at Work ended up having to pay a lot of money to another band.
So you think if you read out their lyrics, they'd try and get the, they'd try and recoup the money that the people have given, contributed to The Guardian, all goes to Men at Work. It's okay. So Barry, I've got the information from producer Joel. In June 2009, 28 years after the release of the recording, Larrikin Music sued Men at Work for copyright infringement, alleging that part of the flute riff of Down Under was copied from Kookaburra. The counsel for the band's record label and publishing company claimed that based on the agreement under which the song was written, the copyright was actually held by the Girl Guides Association. On the 30th of July, Justice Peter Jacobson of the Federal Court of Australia made a preliminary ruling that Larrikin did own copyright on the song, but the issue of whether or not Hay and Stryker had plagiarised the riff was set aside to be determined at a later date. So as yet, we don't know, but even still, it feels like the moment has passed for you to read the lyrics to Men at
Work. Well, Colin Hay, the lead singer of Men at Work, is actually from Scotland. He's not, as you might imagine, the most Australian man alive. And he reckons that the thievery, in inverted commas, of these two bars of a children's nursery rhyme, I think, cost him $4.5 million.
Oh, right.
But if they are Aussie dollars, that's only about 50p, I think, so in real money.
But if you are listening in Australia, you can donate $4.5 million to support The Guardian. And the website, if you're still wondering what it is support.theguardian.com/contribute. Thanks, Ed, for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
We're back on Wednesday after the transfer deadline has finished. We'll do a kind of transfer deadline Europod combo. We'll see you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.